Blog Talk Radio.
Can anybody out there hear my voice? Does anybody out there really care for a missing child?
Good evening, everyone. You're listening to Voices for Justice tonight, November 17th, 2010. I'm your host, Michelle Bart, and tonight, looking for love in all the wrong places, a family's nightmare is Shelby's story. Our guest will be taking your call shortly. The call-in number is 347-838-8622. Again, that number is 347-838-8622. The chat room is also open. Log on to blogtalkradio.com/helpingheroes. 1 year ago, when Shelby was 17 years old, she was involved in a relationship with a man named Anthony Prenzetti, who was 28 years old at the time and a registered convicted sex offender. At that time, Shelby was unaware of his age and the circumstances of his life. She found herself in a mentally, physically, and drug-induced abusive relationship that led her into a psychiatric unit, as well as 44 days in a residential rehab facility. 1 year later, Shelby is on the path of recovery and reaching out to help ensure that other young girls don't fall victim to similar predators. Shelby comes from a loving, successful family, not the stereotypical type family that people usually associate with this situation. Shelby is working towards her bachelor's degree and hopes to be admitted to medical school in 3 years. Shelby is also joined tonight by her wonderful mother, Janet, and stepfather, Jerry. Janet, a hotel executive, and Jerry, a former police officer, missed the red flags. And tonight, a week before Thanksgiving, are so very grateful at how things have turned out for Shelby and their family. All three are here to help other families to know the signs and to tell their story. If you or someone you know is a victim of human trafficking, please call the Human Trafficking Hotline at 888-3737-888. And tonight we welcome Shelby, Janet, and Jerry. Welcome all of you.
Hi. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Good evening. Shelby, let's start with you. Tell our listeners about your journey. How did this all begin?
Well, when I was 17, I had a really close friend who started talking on a dating website, and she was having fun with it, meeting a lot of guys, and it was going good for her. So I also made a profile on the same website and met Anthony through it. Our very first date, we talked on the computer and then on the phone for about 2 months before I agreed to meet him, because I was worried. I had never done online. I know all the dangers of it. And our first date, we met to go to a movie, and I got a phone call 30 minutes after he was supposed to show up because I was about to leave. And he was like, I'm right around the corner. I'll be there in just a couple seconds. And I should have taken that as a red flag from the beginning, that he was late, all these things. And then right as I'm pulling away, you know, he calls and says, I'm right here. Don't worry. So we started dating, and things were going okay. For about a month, we did normal things like going out, you know, taking his dog for walks at the park, going to dinner, normal dates. And then one night I was going to leave his house to go home because I had school the next morning. And he was like, no, don't go. And I was like, no, I need to go. I'll talk to you tomorrow, you know, all the normal things. And he was like, oh, you know what, I know you need to go because of your test, and so I'll give you this pill, and it's great, and you can just pop it in your drink, you'll never taste it, and it's like caffeine, you know. So I said, okay, and I took it, and about 30 minutes later, I felt amazing. I was so awake, energy I'd never felt before. You know, later I found out it was meth, and that's the type of guy he is. I stayed at his house that night, and then he texted my parents from my phone, and he was like, I'm just going to tell them that you're staying at your girlfriend's house, and they'll believe it. And I was like, they won't believe it. They're going to make me come home. Well, it was summer. I was taking summer classes, but I was only taking a couple. So my parents let me stay the night at my friend's house, and it happened to be Anthony's house, because, you know, the friend that I was staying at was somebody my parents knew, somebody that they had, you know, I've grown up with, and they trusted that, so they let me stay there, even though I was really at Anthony's house. This went on for about a week longer of different, you know, friends' house and stuff, and then we went for a drive, and he said we were going to go pick something up, and I wasn't sure what we were going to go get, but I was going to go with him. And at this point, you know, I'm falling really hard for him because he is saying all the right things and doing all the right things at all the right time. And so things seem to be going great. Go out to some really bad neighborhood in Portland, somewhere I had never been. You know, there's gates on all the windows and, you know, trash in the street. It's just not a very good neighborhood. It was getting dark, and we pulled into this empty parking lot near a MAX station, and just a couple weird, weird people, not people I would associate with normally, walked by, and Anthony pulls out this little blue bag. It looks like it's supposed to be a first aid kit. When he opens it, it's full of syringes and, you know, just different paraphernalia that you use to make meth that you can take intravenously. And so at this point, I'm like, what? But just seeing the syringes, I was thinking, oh, those are insulin syringes, and I was thinking he was going to tell me that, you know, he's diabetic, something like that. But this one person walked by just, like, freaking out in the street, talking to himself, and he makes a joke about, oh, there goes another meth head. And I say, yeah, well, that's something I'd never do, and it's not funny to joke about. And he was like, are you kidding? He freaked out on me. He was like, you're so stupid. You know, he's cussing at me, degrading me, and I was thrown aback. I didn't know what to do. I didn't understand what was going on. And then he goes, you've been taking meth for a week. You're an idiot. And I freaked out. I was like, no way. I was like, take me home right now. And he was like, you can get out and take yourself home then. He's like, or you can give me your arm and we're going to do it again. I'm freaking out. There's no way I was going to, at 17, get out in this bad neighborhood where I don't see anybody I would be willing to, like, run in and talk to and be like, help. So, you know, I felt trapped. I didn't know where I even was. So I stayed in the car, did as he told me to do, gave him my arm, and that was the first time that I did it intravenously. And it was an experience that I regret and have to live with every day. because now, you know, I would say that the first time I did it was the very beginning of the addiction. Because the feeling that you get is just different, out of the world. You can't really explain it. From that point on, things went really downhill in our relationship. I attempted to hang out with friends of mine that happened to be males that I have, you know, known since I was a little kid. And he found out that I was hanging out with them. I didn't understand how he knew or anything, but he found out, and he threw me down on the bed when I came over that night, and he held me down, pointed his finger in my face, and said, you know, you will never hang out with another guy ever again, or we'll have some trouble, and just, you know, threatening me, threatening my family. I was scared. You know, I've never had anything like that happen.
How long did the abuse proceed from that point forward?
From that point, my physical abuse went on every few days for about 5 months. And, you know, they really get you to believe that you deserve what you're getting. I felt like I was the bad person, and that because I was talking to other males, even though they were friends, that it was my fault, and I should never have done that, and I deserved getting hit and stuff. And then they, you know, make you feel good about yourself and then tear you down, make you feel good about your relationship, tear you down, all these things. So what people don't understand most of the time is that it's not every day you're living in this horribly abusive relationship. They throw in some good days where they're just pampering you and making you feel great because, you know, that'll keep you there. They know that. They're very good at what they do.
So during the abuse and the drug use, Janet, how did you and your husband and your family miss the red flags?
Well, Shelby had always been the kind of girl who was extremely trustworthy, very responsible, and had a lot of friends, you know, very athletic, very smart, just always was this girl that did what she was said she was going to be doing. So that whole summer when she said she was at a girlfriend and all of these friends we had known since they were young, we believed her because we had no reason not to. For 17 years, she had been, you know, haven't lied. She had been honest about where she was. And then she would come home the next day, and she seemed fine. The only time that there was a couple concerns that we should have seen was one time she said she was at a friend's house, and we actually drove over there to surprise her to take her out for ice cream. And then she said, no, I'm actually not there. I'm at Anthony's house. And we made her come home because we didn't want her to hang out with that Anthony. We really didn't know him, and we had kept trying to get to know him, trying to meet. But according to Shelby, he was working a lot. And the other time was that I took Shelby and her sister to Disneyland, which is a very favorite family vacation. And Shelby just wasn't quite the same enthusiastic person she always was. One morning she didn't even want to get up and go. She just wanted to stay in bed and talk to Anthony on the phone. And I could see something was happening. That, though, was by September, and it was a month later when all of this came down.
So with the red flags, you know, she was away at a friend's house for the most part, but when she was when she'd come home or when she'd call home just to check in, did anything seem out of the norm now that you look back?
Not at all. She would come in, and like our habit, each evening we would sit around and talk, and she would be there with us. You know, she sometimes would be in a bit of a hurry, but that's because she wanted to go on her computer or something like that, which wasn't unusual. But we would check in with each other at the end of the day and talk about what was going on. She seemed fine. We asked about school. You know, we knew she was having a really tough time with the class. It wasn't one that she found too easy. And the other thing was, you know, she did come with us on little weekend vacations, and she seemed perfectly fine.
Michelle,
Jerry, let me ask you something, Jerry. As a former police officer, if by nature the mother can't see anything different, aren't you trained to see the signs? How did this get by a former police officer?
Well, Michelle, frankly, in retrospect, it got by because, as Janet just said, we had 17 years of trusting foundation in Shelby. Honestly and bluntly put, I'm a guy. Shelby and her mom are girls. And, you know, if mom tells me that what's happening is normal for a 17, soon-to-be 18-year-old girl to be kind of pushing away from the family and wanting to be with her girlfriends and that, I have to believe that. I don't know that because I'm not a girl. But some of the signs I miss, the blatant ones, Shelby is an extremely bright girl. She has never had an academic problem. She suddenly ran into a stone wall in her classes that she was taking in the summer voluntarily as part of her high school college program. excuse me. One night, Shelby came home smelling like cigarettes and immediately said, no, that's not, I'm not smoking. I was around people that were smoking, whatever. I should have picked that up because she's not usually around people that are smoking. The fact that Shelby was sleeping all day was really not too much of a concern because it was summer and, you know, kids were off from school, and we had told Shelby that, yes, this summer she could not have to worry about employment. She could just, concentrate on school. I wasn't really worried about that, but when you take all of the "I really wasn't worried about that" and you put them together, you say, why weren't you worried about that, Jerry? Why didn't you see that? And I say that to myself about 5 or 6 times a day.
Well, in the show, another thing is that Shelby was always very focused on going into medicine from middle school through high school, and all of a sudden, she was talking about not going to her college of choice, staying in Portland, maybe doing something different. I just said that was probably her making sure that she was on the right path for her, that she was going to be 18 in a few months, and she was questioning her decisions because she had been so on this one track. And she had teachers who said, you need to think of other alternatives as well. And I figured she was finally listening to those teachers and just giving herself some options before she made that final decision.
But in reality, what was happening was Anthony was manipulating this situation so that Shelby would not only be with him, but would also go out, get a second job, in addition to the one that she had had since she was a sophomore, I guess, in high school. And all of that money that was supposed to be going for college was actually going for Anthony's drug habit. Is that another red flag I missed? Sure. Why wasn't I paying more attention to Shelby's bank account? Once again, it's...
Because you trusted her.
Yeah, it's 17 years of trust. If she told me she was going to be on the corner of 5th and Main, that's where she was. And if she said it was going to be at 12:06, she was there at 12:06. We've always done things with her. Her volleyball experiences that she had as a teenager, Her mom and I attended practically, if not every game. We went on trips with her for the volleyball team. We had no reason to suspect Shelby would ever do anything other than be the head-down straight student.
Well, and Michelle, another thing you asked, you know, had we been communicating with her that summer? Absolutely. We text as a family quite a bit, and she texted us often. What we found out after this all came down was that she wasn't texting us. It was Anthony who was texting us, but he was using the kind of language Shelby would use. So we believed that we were in constant communication with Shelby.
That's very interesting, because obviously we hear a lot on traffickers and organized crime, if you will, how they're able to manipulate not just the victim but the people around them. So let's fast forward, Janet. From a mother's standpoint, you and Jerry are at home. You get a knock at the door. Take our listeners from that point forward.
Okay. So what happened was the police came to our door while I was at work, and our older daughter answered, and he said he wanted to talk to me. And so she called, and I spoke to him, and he told us that he believed that Shelby was involved with a convicted sex offender named Anthony Pranzetti, and did I know him? And I said, we've been trying to get to know him for a couple months, but he seems like he works all the time. And I asked, how do you know this? Well, Anthony at this point was in jail for a drug offense. And so we set up a situation where that policeman would come to our house the next day when I knew Shelby would be home. And we had all of us there. And he showed up at the door, and we all sat down, including Shelby. And he looked at Shelby and said, do you know how old Anthony Pranzetti is? And Shelby said, 28. And I was, from that point on, I was stunned. And I'm still stunned a year later. She had just recently found out he was actually 28, but she was too deeply involved in the relationship. She was too afraid to get out of it, and she was so addicted to meth, which was such a shock. So we sat there for a long time, and he talked to Shelby, talked to us. Shelby confirmed a lot of things. Shelby cried a lot. She was scared, and we found out that Anthony's methamphetamines actually were in our home in a bag. He was having her hold those until he was getting out of jail. So the police... Shelby was great, I have to say. She went in, she got them. She also got another bag and said, I don't know what's in here, it's sealed. And the policeman opened it, and it was a lot of people's ID. And so he was also doing some identity theft. The whole thing overwhelmed Shelby so much. I think the policeman was with us for 2 hours, that apparently Shelby had a suicide pact with Anthony. And if she ever got caught, or, you know, the police came and told us what was going on, she was supposed to kill herself. So in front of me, she was threatening to do that, and I kind of was trying to, but I could tell she was such a mess. We fortunately were able to take her to an emergency room, and they admitted her to a psychiatric unit that day, which I'm so grateful for, because I wouldn't have known how to handle her coming home. She was like no Shelby I ever knew. It was a horrible situation. And from that point on, you know, she went to rehab, but there isn't a day that I don't spend most of my day thinking about what's happened.
And what has happened to, we could say, that Anthony... Tell us a little bit, Jerry, what Anthony was charged with. Drug trafficking? Sex trafficking?
He was charged with three counts of sexual assault on a minor. He was charged with three counts of forcibly introducing narcotics to the body of a minor. He was charged with two counts of identity theft. He was not charged with trafficking because it couldn't be proved, although every police officer I have spoken to at every level from city through federal tells me we were probably about 2 weeks away from never seeing Shelby again. He also has a federal case pending for possession, production, and distribution of child pornography. Aside from that, he's been a pretty good boy in the last year and a half. I know that sounds sarcastic, but I've been spending since October 26th of last year, I've spent a solid 5 or 6 months every day, 3 to 4 hours a day on the phone with law enforcement at various levels. And as the district attorney said to me, he has not seen anyone quite as tenacious or quite as nasty as I am, as far as Anthony goes. And I'm proud of that, frankly. I want Anthony put away and put in a freezer somewhere.
Shelby, let me ask you, in regards to the pornographic issue at hand, he video recorded your experiences with him, correct?
Yes.
Is there any concern in your mind that those are in the hands of the public at this point, or have they been pretty much seized?
Law enforcement is doing all that they can to get them off the computers and stuff, but internet is very, very widespread, you know. I personally don't know exactly where it all went because I also don't want to know, you know.
Right.
It's hard to know that what I thought was really intimate and special and important, you know, for him it was just getting money or, you know, just having more child pornography to throw on the computer and all these things. And to me, sex is really intimate, and that's really hard to know that it's for everyone to see now. But law enforcement's doing all that they can, and they've been great. They've gotten a lot off that I know of. But another issue is that, you know, Anthony's a very bad man, and he had lots of other child pornography too. So it wasn't just me. Whether he was in those videos and whatnot, I don't know, but he at least had it all. And it's disgusting to me.
So for our listeners, and I know that we have many survivors listening to this show tonight that want somebody to speak out, in regards to why you didn't try to get help to get away from Anthony, can you explain to those of us that can't understand why somebody stays in a situation when there's so many services out there to get out, or a loving family in your case?
Well, to start, when I did try to seek help that very first time, that one time with calling that friend, and, you know, I was then choked and, you know, slammed up against the wall. At that point, him saying those things like, you know, you do that again, we're going to have some problems, your family's going to be hurt. I was very, even loved my family so much that I would rather be hurt than have my family hurt. So I felt like at that point I was just kind of doomed. And my head couldn't really wrap around that this was happening to me. It was very surreal at that point. You know, and the meth is a really big part. Once I had been introduced and addicted, I had no other way to get it. How was I supposed to, you know, keep up with my addiction without Anthony around? Not that I really I think, mentally wanted to, but physically I wanted it very badly. And
do you still today?
Yes and no, honestly. It's an addiction, and with all the help and counseling and rehab I've gone through, I have the skills and the tools to fight it and say no, obviously. But people need to know that an addiction is always going to be there, and it's always going to be hard. There are triggers that happen in my life that make me think about a time when Anthony and I did that, or, you know, and it just hurts me. But having gone through rehab, Northwest Behavioral was an amazing place, and they did give me the skills and tools that I need. So at this point, yeah, I still want it every now and then, but I don't want it because I like what it did to me and I like what happened. I want it because physically it numbs you, and I would rather be numb at that moment than think about Anthony and everything that happened.
And how do you feel about the fact that you were powerful and you were able to take back the power and stand up to him and see him prosecuted and is serving time behind bars? How do you feel about him being in prison?
I honestly feel really indifferent about it. That sounds weird, but again, people don't understand the emotional tie that you get to these horrible people. I feel as though I know mentally he deserves what he's getting and he belongs there, but emotionally, I feel very guilty and responsible that, you know, I'm putting someone in prison and, you know, wanting to be in medicine. I've watched, like, TV shows like Lock Up and those types of things where I see what happens in prisons and all those things, and I feel responsible that I'm putting him in that situation. I know that's not the truth. He did it to himself. He did it before I was even with him. You know, he's done this before, and that's hard for people, you know, to get, is that he's done this before, so he really does deserve what he's getting. But I feel very indifferent. I still, you know, have to think about everything that happened, and it's a battle every day, basically.
There's a question in the chat room. She'd like to know if you ever felt the need to protect him at any time.
That's a really good question, and yeah, I did. At the very beginning, when the police were at my house, my mom and stepdad went through. But what I went through that day was very, very different. As I pulled up to my house, I was coming home from class, and there was a police car parked in front of my neighbor's door. So, you know, I didn't think it had to deal with me, but I was actually on the phone with Anthony at that point, and he was like, they're coming to talk to you. And I was like, it's in front of my neighbor's house. Like, I'm sure something else happened. Or, no, they're coming. Like, he knew. He knew what was going on. Didn't tell me what was going on, obviously.
He thought you would kill yourself as part of the plan.
Yeah, that plan pack thing, it's hard to explain. And as I say it sober, it sounds really dumb, and I know that. But when you're high and in love and all these different things, it sounded good at the time, but it was more like he made me feel wanted than, oh, if somebody catches you, kill yourself, because that sounds stupid. It's more like if something happens and we can't be together, then, you know, you'll need to kill yourself so that we can be together. Because he played off that he was really religious because he knew that I was religious. So played into those things. He plays into all your, you know, insecurities, and then also all the things that you like, they like, all those things. So that day when the police came, I was very bent on protecting him at first. At one point, the police said, you know what, Shelby, you don't need to protect him because we've been listening to your conversations for a month and a half, and anything you say, we already know the truth, and, you know, we've read every letter that you guys have sent to each other and all these things. At that point, they already know what's going on. What more can I do? I'd rather, you know, help myself. But at the same time, Anthony was, you know, we were on the phone with each other like 2 minutes ago. So I wasn't quite sure what to do. It took about 2 weeks before I fully gave up all the information that I knew. And that was because I was giving out, I wasn't going to volunteer any information at that point for the first 2 weeks, because that's what I had been trained to do, is not volunteer any information. Once I had finished my first week of rehab after the psychiatric unit, I was in a very better mental state. I wasn't perfect, but things were a lot better, and I could see clearly a little more, and I had gone through the withdrawal, so I wasn't, you know, on the drugs anymore. And that's when I started to give all the information up that I knew. And it was hard. It was emotionally hard. But
Jerry, what are your biggest concerns, Jerry, with Anthony being in prison? Do you have any?
Yes, I have two. One is that the facility he's in is Oregon's facility for those that are child predators or child molesters, and he is in administrative segregation, meaning that all of the predators are together, and in effect they are training one another, and he'll have 10 years of intensive training. And my next concern is that the same thing will happen as happened during his last prison sentence. He was released from prison to a status of homeless. Well, it's very, very hard to keep track of somebody who's homeless. My concern is, and frankly, I'm on the verge of making this my next crusade, is to get the legislature to pass legislation that would not allow someone to be released from prison to the status of homeless. They would have to have a physical address to which they could go. I'm not concerned about Anthony bothering Shelby or coming after Shelby. I think one of the wisest things that was said to me was said by a Washington County detective, and that was, and I'm almost quoting verbatim here, Anthony's going to go to a place where by the time he's getting out of it, he will not even remember Shelby's name. And I do believe that's true. But I also believe he's being very thoroughly trained, cross-trained, having his skills honed by current predators that are in there and the new ones that are coming in, and the new ones know how they got caught, and they're going to be keeping them up to date on technology and things like that.
Do you believe, from being a former police officer and any of you actually, especially Shelby, do you believe that people that are predators, sexual predators, husbands or boyfriends or fathers that are sitting at home with pornographic images on computers and watching it in television and all of that, do you believe that those individuals who have committed a crime can be rehabilitated?
I'm going to answer that as a former police officer, and I'll let the other, Jen and Shelby answer in a second. Personally, no, I don't. That's a personal opinion. However, the last arrest I made as a police officer was of a child molester in an elementary school who had only had two prior convictions, and this is before three strikes and you're out. But, you know, how many times are we going to give a chance here? The cure doesn't work, short of surgery.
I agree with him. I don't believe someone like this can be rehabilitated. They're just wired wrong from the start. I'm not sure what happened to him growing up. But, you know, before he went to prison in Eastern Oregon, he was put in the Coffee Creek facility in Wilsonville for about a month while they worked on his rehabilitation plan. And I thought that was pretty crazy, considering he still had 10 more years to spend in prison. I mean, if you're going to work on a plan, why don't we work on it when it's closer to a release date? But I know that the system tries very hard.
I, personally, I don't believe that Anthony or someone in Anthony's situation can be fixed or rehabilitated. But I do think I have a little more hope in mankind, I guess. And I think that there are people who do make mistakes, because I made a mistake and I was rehabilitated. And I know it's different, but I still, you know, made a mistake too. And I got help and it went okay. And I'm still getting help. And it's going a lot better.
Do you think there's a difference, though, Shelby, as a victim and now a survivor who was lured, lied to, drugged? You know, it wasn't like you started the ball rolling. You were brought into that life. Do you think there's a difference between that and an individual that commits heinous crimes against women and children and some boys, that they can't stop doing what they're doing and it's all about them or nothing at all? Whereas, like, let's take Anthony. It wasn't his first offense. He had served time, and in this particular case, he was only out, what, 2-3 months out of jail the first time around, when he baited you on plenty of fish. So, pardon the pun, but that's exactly what he did. And he found somebody that he knew he would be able to make his next victim. And yet he was in jail for doing the same thing previously, and yet they released him into society again.
Yeah, I do think that there's a difference. Obviously, there's a big difference. But I think that there are people who can be rehabilitated. I mean, it does depend on how they grow, you know, work. Grown up, raised. I don't know Anthony's true background because I got a lot of lies, so I can't say about him. I know that I don't think Anthony can be fixed, and I think that if he gets out or when he gets out, however anybody wants to put it to make themselves feel better, he's going to do it again. He did it before. His motto when I was with him was, if it's illegal, it makes it more fun. And, you know, these things that he's doing are never going to be legal, so they're always going to be more fun for him.
And that sounds like a line he probably picked up the first time around behind bars. Terry, let me ask you, you mentioned, you know, you'd like to see bills passed in reference to if they don't have a place to go, that they shouldn't be released. And I second that theory. But I go a step further with it, because I saw down in San Diego on a case I was on where John Gardner was released many of times and indicated he lived one place, when he never really lived there. And we saw in Hazeldale for Anissa Nip, the 14-year-old that lost her life just walking home from her house, and a homeless pedophile who was interviewed, I should say, by a local reporter and aired that night, only to be found 6 hours later, was actually the person that did the heinous crime and raped and murdered the 14-year-old. These are individuals that are homeless, and I can't tell you in Clark County where I live how many the Colombian newspapers show each and every day that I saw months ago that actually were at an address and no longer that status, but homelessness now, and yet they're still out on the streets. Do you really think letting them out after 2-3 strikes that they should be let go?
No, I don't. If in keeping with our American way and our Judeo-Christian background of saying that people are capable of being rehabilitated, okay, I'll play that game for a short while, but I'm going to say I want a foolproof system of monitoring, not some bracelet that can be slipped off an ankle. Maybe a bracelet that goes around the neck and cannot get taken off. And if it gets taken off, it gives off a jolting electric shock that will stun somebody. I'm sorry. I'm very sincere about this. That guy slipped out from his probation officer's hold, and ironically enough, the probation officer's husband was the arresting officer that arrested him after he OD'd in the parking lot of a garden apartment complex. It never would have happened that he was arrested and found and the pieces put together if they hadn't been married, because her entry of his being missing from parole hadn't made it up through the system yet to get out to the street officer to say, yes, this guy is wanted. So, gee, happenstance, good luck, yes, I'm great about that. And I'm sorry that, you know, if I got really graphic and really grotesque about how I would monitor somebody, I'm sorry about that, but that's exactly the kind of monitoring I think is needed. And I think until we can absolutely assure we know exactly where these people are, that's what we're going to have to do. Can't keep them
you know,
in jail.
Though, I know that this goes down a different topic here, but I'm reading something that's in the chat room, and they're saying, do they give them money to be released or go to a homeless shelter? And we know that that depends on the state you live in and all. But for me, you know, there's more victims. Just let's take the United States. We have more victims in history than we do prosecutions. And for me, many of those victims are repeat pedophiles, are repeat rapists, are repeat murderers. And yet we still... they have more rights, it seems, than the poor victims that we constantly talk about, such as, you know, J.C. Dugard, Elizabeth Smart. These are individuals with rap sheets that went through, and these are people that are being caught now. What about all the people that still have yet to been caught, and all the children, women, and boys and everybody that have been victimized, and the families? I can't imagine what you all have been through this year. Janet, I mean, you're a mother, you know?
I know, and you know,
how do you handle that?
I'm so incredibly sad all the time and angry, and it alternates, but you know, I know that when we first met, I was just in a bubble in disbelief that this happened to someone in my family after, you know, raising her in such a way. I'm not in disbelief anymore. I'm angry, sad this happened to us, and that's why I'm speaking out, because it's not fair to these families who work so hard to raise their children in the right way, and someone can come along in a month or 2 weeks and destroy everything that you have done.
You know, you take Shelby as an example. She wants to be a doctor, and I she'll have as much support as we can possibly give her to make that happen. But how about this next step? Here's Dr. Shelby. Well, wait a minute, isn't that my doctor in that child porn picture? It's not funny. It's real. It's another step of how the pedophile, how the aggressor, how the sex trafficker takes the victim. He sits in prison for 10 years, and then he waltzes out. Shelby lives with that for the next 50 to 60 years.
It really upsets me that all the police officers and people we've talked to say that he'll not remember my name. Which, yeah, that's good that he won't remember my name, but it hurts because I know that every day for the rest of my entire life, I will for sure remember his name. I will remember everything. And that's something where he has no conscience about it, and he's going to forget, and he's going to be like, oh, yeah, some, B-word put me in prison, but it's okay because now I got this new girl or whatever he's going to say. He doesn't care.
You all do have a lot of support in the chat room. I'm not sure if you are online, but we have an author, Deborah Davis, that will be actually one of our guests on our show December 10th. She's thanking you, Shelby, for being brave and speaking out, and she loves your parents. You have great parents and a great support system. We also have people saying, abusers will never take the blame, and repeat criminals are showing us they intend to do this as far as we let them. And I completely get that because you just can't sit back and keep watching families like you, break apart. How has this experience of speaking out now to other parents, Janet, but how have the restraints been? How is things with your other daughter and the family and friends?
Well, you notice my older daughter is not here speaking with us, and she won't, which we respect that. She doesn't want to have anything to do with this. She's tired of hearing about it. She said that's all we talk about. And because it's on our mind all the time, it is kind of what we dwell on. And she moved out of the home probably about 2 months after Shelby, after the police came to our house, because she couldn't stand what it was happening to our family. And, I have to say, we're a great, solid family, but it's caused a huge amount of stress. And though I'm saying I want to speak out on this, and I've been doing that, it's hard. It's hard because it just keeps bringing everything back to the surface, and I tend to be someone who wants to just bury it and have it go away. But it doesn't go away. And I don't want this to happen to anyone else.
You asked
Jerry, can parents get over something like this that has happened to their child, Jerry?
Yes. Parents cannot get over it. Parents can learn to live with it. Parents can learn to adjust to it. You asked about friends. That's been one of our major support groups, have been our friends. I frequently say this to people that don't know me well. My best friend is my attorney, and my attorney is my best friend. And I don't mean that I sue people every day. It just means that these people are terrific in the support they've given us, the advice they've given us, the guidance they've given us, the fact that, they trust Shelby. They have had Shelby house sit for them. They've had Shelby babysit for them. All of those things. Because of that kind of a support group, we're able, as parents, to function socially. We're able to, even go out and have fun. were able to get over the trauma of it. And you know, something that hasn't been mentioned here, but it needs to be mentioned. This is not a cheap thing. Shelby's rehab isn't a gift from the state. If a parent doesn't have insurance, they would be looking at somewhere in the vicinity of $50,000 to $60,000 for 44 days of residential rehab. That doesn't include the psychiatric hospital or the emergency room. Or the ambulance that may have been necessary. That was necessary. That's a heck of a financial hit on a family. And he sits there in jail getting his $10 a day for being a good boy so he can buy stuff from the commissary.
Now, Holy cow, he gets $10 a day? That's more than jury duty.
I know. I'm working very hard to get that $10 a day attached and sent to Shelby.
I think that would be a great idea. Well, you know, I don't think that criminals behind bars should be getting paid.
No,
that's
they
a whole nother show, Jerry.
Here you go.
That's a whole nother show. We have a few minutes left. Jerry, Janet, any last thoughts and any last words for our listeners? We want everyone to know, listening, that you will be at the Northwest Conference Against Trafficking in Portland, Oregon, January 15th at the Convention Center. They will be speaking from a family's point of view as our surviving families. So please join us. You can find more about that at nwcat.org. But any last thoughts on where you were, how you got here, and where you're going?
Well, I'm really so pleased to say that Shelby is continuing with her studies and is planning to go out of state to a university in January. And this was her dream, and she has decided the past few months that she wants to pursue the dream she's had. And so right now we're working very hard on making that happen, getting her registered for this school. And I'm absolutely thrilled that she's going to do this. However, I worry constantly about her, that she'll fall victim to someone again. I worry all the time. I worry about every person she talks to.
Well, the thing that I would say to parents is this. First off, if something isn't right, if something doesn't smell right, it probably isn't right. Go look at it. Go start investigating. And it's not going to put a wall between you and your child. The child may get mad at that moment, but it could avoid a situation like we encountered. That's number one. Number two, as far as Shelby goes, yes, I'm equally thrilled that she's taking the opportunity. I'm going to use her own words. I decided that I'm going to go to school. Why should I let him take that dream away from me? And as far as Janet and Jerry go, yeah, we're going to be supporting Shelby. Jerry put his police hat back on in October, and it hasn't come off yet. Jerry's in contact with police in the school, the area where she's going to school, to find out things about what's happening out there. I'm not going to be there with her all the time. They don't know who she is, but I'm getting a reading on the area.
Anyway,
Shelby?
No. Yeah? I would say, as a survivor, I just want girls and women, and even men, because this happens to men too. I think that everyone needs to find their boundaries and set them really strong, and it's really important to have good self-worth, and those are things that I learned. It's hard to learn those things, but it's really important. So I would just say, you know, be confident in who you are and your morals and your values, and set those boundaries and keep the boundaries.
One other thought.
Janet, you were
going
to say something?
I'd like to just add one real quick thought. Parents, if you're listening and the police come to your door, cooperate with them. They're on your side, particularly if it's your child that's the victim. Believe me, I have had nothing but total cooperation from the local, state, county, and federal authorities. They have been outstanding.
Yes, the only other thing I was going to say is, at first it was really hard to tell anybody what was happening with our family and with Shelby. But what I find now is that the people I talk to one-on-one say that I'm such a strong person to be able to speak out, and now I feel like I have to speak out because, I don't know, I feel like maybe this is a mission in life now that I need to work, you know, towards the goal of having less of this happen, especially in Portland where we are.
Definitely, definitely. And for those listening, again, the hotline number, if you or someone you know is being trafficked or exploited, the phone number is 888-3737-888. You can also visit www.nwcat.org or polarisproject.org and get the help that you need. Definitely, you need to talk. You can't hold stuff like this in. And so all of those agencies have wonderful services available. Shelters are very lax, and we only have two in the country, and we are working every day, including Seroptimus International and Seroptimus International of the Northwestern region. We're doing our part. We need more help from all of you. Rotary, Kiwanis, Lions Club, any agencies out there now, any agencies that have volunteers that are trying to make a difference in this world need to come together, and let's have a voice like we did years ago when we needed domestic violence shelters. They have been a godsend to all of the victims who are now speaking out and are empowered and are survivors. So thank you to all of our listeners and our guests. Our next show is next Wednesday. In an exclusive here on Voices for Justice, we sit down with the late James Brown's rape victim, Jackie Hollander. Until then, remember, we can all be a voice for justice. What will you do this week to make a difference? Be the change you wish to see in the world, and we'll see you next week. Thank you so much, and good night, everyone.